the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham. This is Due South on WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Welcome in to our North Carolina News and Politics Roundup, where we will review, analyze, and try to make some sense of recent happenings across the Old North State. Here for our conversation are Colin Campbell, Capitol Bureau Chief at WUNC, Don Vaughn, Capitol Bureau Chief at the News and Observer, Danielle Battaglia on the line from Capitol Hill, where she's the correspondent for the News and Observer, as well as the Charlotte Observer. And also with us from Charlotte is Steve Harrison, political reporter at NPR member station WFAE. Good morning, y'all.
Good morning, Jeff.
All right.
Good morning.
Analysis, context, hopefully some levity here in the next hour or so from our panelists. But first, the music police.
Our economists predict that this project will lift North Carolina's economy by more than $4.7 billion.
I've been speaking truth in talking about how we want to get back to the basics of education.
It's just shown there's much more demand for it. There's a lot of parents who want their kids to be attending either religious or private school.
Moore says he thinks the budget will still have money for teacher raises, but he wasn't sure how lawmakers will approach a request to fund childcare facilities that are grappling with the loss of federal money this year.
Now there is a barcode on each and every sexual assault kit, and the victim has that number and can go to a website and will know exactly where that kid is.
We are announcing $1 billion in funding for states and territories to conduct initial testing and treatment at public water systems.
Falling in line behind violent rhetoric in the name of party unity, another $250 million and then some for some schools, and what to do about a 38-year-old sports arena with a really lousy concourse, if we're being totally honest. All of that. But first, let's begin with a state visit. The Prime Minister of Japan touched down in our state yesterday. The trip coincided, more or less, with Japanese company Fujifilm Biotechnologies announcing that it plans to add some 680 jobs to a pharmaceutical manufacturing facility in Holly Springs. Colin, why is Fujifilm expanding in southern Wake County? And was this the primary reason for the Prime Minister's visit?
So I think the fact that the announcement came a little bit ahead of the actual visit suggests to me that this was in the works, and they kind of wanted to time it a little bit closely to sort of just show the economic impact that Japanese companies have on North Carolina. Governor Cooper, in his remarks at the event yesterday, mentioned that, you know, thousands of North Carolinians are going to work every day for various Japanese companies. So Fujifilm, this is a subsidiary of theirs that basically does medical manufacturing. They said this will sort of facility will help in pandemic preparedness and some other things. They had already several years ago announced about 700 jobs there. That's under construction now. They're essentially doubling the number that they're putting there. So really a bigger boost to what they want to do in Holly Springs, a vote of confidence for that site, the workforce that it's likely to employ. Apparently, North Carolina was up against several foreign countries as possible locations for this type of facility. So a big economic development win for North Carolina. And as the governor said, we're really getting into this kind of niche manufacturing biopharma space as a main aspect of North Carolina's economy, particularly in the Triangle and the sort of the outlying communities of the Triangle, like Holly Springs and Clayton and some of these other places where it's become very popular to put this type of manufacturing facility.
Yeah. This southern Wake County tier crescent that's up against Johnston County, it's one of the fastest growing regions of the state. Don, what else did we glean from why they're bringing these jobs here? I think Colin touched on a lot of it, but, you know, from the infrastructure to the labor force, was there anything else that struck you as to, you know, why Fujifilm is saying, hey, we're going to invest several billion dollars and bring hundreds of jobs here to North Carolina?
Well, we all know why North Carolina is the greatest state, right? But other people have discovered that too. And it's the workforce. It's the, you know, the educated workforce, the labor force. It's that mix of Democrat-Republican split that for a while for North Carolina has been enough of the mix of the draws here to be a good place to come to work. I mean, there's the reason that CNBC, you know, puts North Carolina at the top for business every year.
Steve Harrison on the line in Charlotte. I don't know, candidly, to what extent you tracked this visit by the Prime Minister, this jobs announcement that came on Thursday. But what can you tell us about the kinds of jobs that are going to be in southern Wake County and/or, and I'm getting to a little bit of a pet peeve here in a second, has nothing to do with you. We heard about average salary. What can you tell us about wages and just the types of positions that are coming?
So I'm going to have to. I was not covering this story directly, the Fujifilm thing, so I will have to defer back to Colin on that one, just in terms of wages and where that plant is. But, you know, clearly, as Colin said, just a huge new segment of the state's economy.
I threw you under the bus there, Steve. That's a real time apology, Colin. Just briefly
that's
on.
All right.
We're getting to my pet peeve. That's really all this is about.
So this average salaries here is just above $100,000. So just enough to afford a house in Wake County, probably given those wages. But yeah, higher than the sort of typical average wages for North Carolina. So that's been touted as a big boon in this project.
But it's average. And here's my gripe. And when I was on the political beat with y'all, I would ask folks from the North Carolina Commerce Department, I'd say, what's the median salary? What is the median? Can I have the median? Because if you have a couple of really big executive C-suite salaries, like if most people are making between, and I'm just making it up here on the fly, between 50 and 70, but you've got a couple of people who are making $600,000 or $800,000, it pulls the whole thing up.
Drags it up, yeah. And so you can't really tell what's the run-of-the-mill, you know, frontline factory worker going to be making there. It may not actually be six figures.
I'd like to know what the minimum salary is. That would give you a lot
more.
Absolutely. What's the range?
Place?
Right. Yeah. I got my median, my average, my mode. Okay, I'm not a math teacher, but I needed to get the brief pet peeve out here. Danielle Battaglia is with us on the line. She's McClatchy's Capitol Hill correspondent. There was, of course, a state visit in D.C. this week. Set the scene, if you would, Danielle, or give us a little bit of color from what you observed or experienced on that front.
I actually love these state visits because D.C. goes all out where the Japanese flag is all over Capitol Hill. It's all over the White House. I'm not cool enough to get invited to the state dinner, but, you know, we get the run through and the breakdowns from the vice president's office, the president's office of everyone going in. Governor Cooper came here with his wife to be at the state dinner. As far as I know, he was the only governor invited to the state dinner. I'm really hoping he sat next to Robert De Niro. It looked like from one of the press emails we got, they may have sat together at the head table. So I just like the flair that goes on in D.C. when these state dinners take place.
81-year-old Robert De Niro is the child, the father of a two-year-old, one-year-old child. He has a baby. I saw that recently in like a People magazine that was sitting somewhere, and I was kind of astonished by it. I want to ask you just about the cultural touch point here. There are many beautiful times to visit Washington, D.C., but right about now is one of the best times for my money because of the cherry blossoms. Did the prime minister's visit coincide with the blossoming, the full blossom of cherry blossoms, or are we just past it?
We are technically just past it, but we are still like, we're just past peak, but we are still in it. So he probably could have seen it. I was on Capitol Hill yesterday, and there were many people visiting the Capitol Hill. Well, actually, the Capitol's inner gift shops, which had a ton of cherry blossom things you could buy.
There you go.
So these are like the non-visitor center, but actual like Congress can shop at.
Okay.
I
think I follow.
I think I need to go to that gift shop because I actually have a lot of cherry blossom merch that I've gotten from going up there. So, Danielle, I will ask you later about what there is and what I can get. I thought of you. Governor Cooper put out a photo from the dinner, and there was another governor. It's Governor Cooper with Kristen Cooper and then Kathy Hochul. That was the photo of them at the dinner.
But they're not coming here, which is
to her.
Pretty rare to see a sitting head of state from another country tooling around North Carolina. I think the agenda for today includes visits to the Toyota battery plant that's being built over near Greensboro, a couple other facilities related to Japanese companies. They're going to stop by NC State. They're going to go look at an ancient Japanese doll that's held at the Science or History Museum in Raleigh.
Natural
it was a pretty
sciences.
Jam-packed visit. And they get to eat barbecue and Ashley Christensen food for lunch. So a full North, if you can pack North Carolina into one single day, I think they're going to do that today.
I do wonder
Honda Jet. They're going to Honda Jet in Greensboro as well.
Right. Honda Jet has this subsidiary, this manufacturing facility at Piedmont Triad International Airport. And it's a really interesting visit, but there's also this kind of multi-pronged symbolism that y'all are just noting. I do wonder, on a less serious note, if there's an opportunity for Asian barbecue fusion at any point today, like sushi barbecue fusion.
I'll be interested. Ashley Christensen is a pretty innovative chef, and I think she's teaming up with one of the trying to recall the name, but one of the Eastern North Carolina barbecue masters. So what exactly that looks like, I'm intrigued to see. I'm not fancy enough to get invited to that. The press access to this visit is very limited. I think it's a press pool where only a couple of journalists get to actually spend time with the prime minister. So security is very tight around this visit.
I threw Steve Harrison of WFAE a curveball a little bit earlier, and I'm just going to throw a curveball to the panel now. I was in doing the preparation for the show today, I read that today's state visit for NC State University is the first in 70 years. Do we know the last time the prime minister from Japan was in North Carolina, if ever, or if there is another recent state visit that comes to mind? Because I didn't have anything as I was thinking about this.
Yeah, I can't think of, I mean, we've had plenty of visits from like the ambassador from wherever or the consul general or something, but that's usually the highest level you get at the state level.
And if you remember, Cooper went to Japan last year. It was that time where Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson used as acting governor, and Cooper was in Japan then. So I'm sure he's thinking about that, too, be like, well, it paid off that I went.
We are just getting going on our North Carolina News Roundup, news and politics here on Due South. We do it each Friday at 10 o'clock. If you want to get caught up with other Due South offerings from the week that was, please head over to WUNC.org or DueSouthRadio.org. On the other side, still lots to get to, including some outlandish comments that we've been discussing in recent weeks here on the program. Well, one of the highest ranking Republicans weighed in on what Michelle Morrow had said years ago on social media. We'll get reaction to what he said, why, and why he said it now on the other side. Danielle Battaglia, Steve Harrison, Don Vaughn, and Colin Campbell with you as we roll on here on Due South on WUNC. Welcome back. It's Due South. Davis Love III has a big birthday tomorrow. The Charlotte native played golf at UNC Chapel Hill, earning All-American honors three times. He was also the ACC tournament champion in 1984. Love III subsequently had a long career on the PGA Tour, during which time he won one major, the 1997 PGA Championship, and finished twice at the Masters in 1995 and 1999. The Masters, of course, playing out right now. Round two at Augusta National has already teed off today. Love was inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame 7 years ago, and on Saturday, he celebrates his 60th. Happy birthday to Davis Love III, and also happy birthday to a very special someone who is 50 years younger than Davis Love. My son will be six tomorrow. Welcome back. Thank you. Thank you. Welcome back to our news and politics roundup here on listener-supported North Carolina Public Radio. We're with Colin Campbell of WUNC, Steve Harrison of WFAE, Danielle Battaglia of McClatchy, and Don Vaughn of the News and Observer. Let's turn to public schools and state funding. We learned this week that Republican lawmakers plan to appropriate more money, as they have done pretty much every year for a decade, for opportunity scholarships, so-called private school vouchers. Don, how big is the plan? How much more in an appropriation can we expect?
We could be seeing $300 million. That's the ask for it. And Speaker Moore, when he talked to us, you know, session hasn't started yet, but he came for the gavel in and out and talked to the reporters there. And he said that it might be that much, but he, you know, didn't have exact numbers yet, as they are just now starting to talk about what the budget adjustments will be. But if the money's there, then that's what they want to do is meet demand. And he's confident. One of my questions was, where's that coming from? You know, and he's like, oh, no, the money's there. So, but the money's not quite there, if he's still not sure exactly how much money they could
get.
Yeah,
the revenue figures that they used to budget are not in yet. It usually comes in after tax season, which of course is in the next couple days. And that'll sort of determine that, you know, availability for that, for teacher raises, for child care facilities, various other competing interests that we're going to see in the budget process.
Sure, it's a squishy, fudgy kind of conversation. But Colin, remind us, there are several billion dollars available to lawmakers when we think about cash on hand. Is there not?
Yeah, they tend to put a lot in the bank. A lot of it goes towards what's known as the rainy day fund, which is intended for a rainy day. And in North Carolina's case, that's often a hurricane. But it'll be interesting to see if there's an appetite to, if they're short on cash, pull from one of those, you know, savings funds to fund the private school voucher program, which of course is going to be ongoing, not really a one-time expense. Once you sign people up for this program, they're probably going to want it throughout the time that their kids are in school. So what sort of, you know, continuing funding needs that involves is going to be a challenge for them to figure out. This is a program that already has several automatic step-ups in the state budget bill going out, I think, almost a decade. But the demand was so high initially when they opened it up to all income levels that you had this situation where they had way more people applying than they had money. So they've only given it to the people at the lowest end of the income spectrum so far. And this would allow them to open it back up to everybody and say, you know, even though you make six figures and you applied for this, you're still going to get the private school voucher.
It's important to note that since it is tax time, that's our taxpayer money. Like, yes, it's in the account, but that's still, we're all paying for it.
Go one level deeper there for us, Dawn. What do you mean by that? Just in layperson's terms. I follow
okay.
you, but I want
so
to.
So the state government budget is funded by all of us taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
So when they say they have the money, it's the money that they're that we're paying every year in taxes that
right.
they're using for this. It's not like, you know, it's just this
yeah.
endless
pool of federal money,
print
which
money
is also our
Maryland,
taxes.
Right.
It's just in the federal tax account as opposed to what I owe the state this year.
Right. It's just the time of year to think about what is the government doing with
yeah.
my money.
Well,
right.
Those of us who have to write checks instead of get refunds are pondering how much we're giving the government.
I want to, I think, expound a little bit on something Colin just mentioned, which I think is important contextually as we understand opportunity scholarships, a.k.a. vouchers, which is, excuse me, when the Republicans push this as a priority, going back a decade, 11 or 12 years since they've been in power, this was initially a program that was available to not all families, to folks working middle class, maybe upper middle class, and it capped out, I believe, at around household income of $90,000. And what they did 2 years ago, I believe, was they removed the cap. Maybe it was just last year, but they removed the cap. So now you could live in a home that is earning $300,000, $400,000 or $5 million. It's curtailed. It's prorated.
Yeah, you get less money if you make yeah. more money. And it's still, you know, it's... It helps you afford private schools. It doesn't go all the way for a lot of private schools. The higher tier private schools, some of them don't even take vouchers, but a lot of them, if they do, that's only going to cover a small chunk of what it actually costs to attend one of these private schools. So you're still, you know, it doesn't necessarily make it free in a lot of cases.
It's a philosophical difference in how you fund education. So the idea behind the supporters of it isn't as much we want to pay this money for public education because that's the government's responsibility. It's also that they want to give the money to the families. So they've described it as a backpack. So the money follows the kid, and it doesn't matter necessarily how much the parents make. They want that money to follow the kid wherever they go to school. And in this case, it's private schools, which of course do not have the regulations that public schools do.
One of the critiques that we have heard from public education proponents is that this money being moved over to the voucher pot, if you will, is coming at the expense of funding for public schools. Steve Harrison, I'm going to throw you another curveball here. If you'd like to weigh in on this one, what can you tell us about some of the critiques of increased funding for opportunity scholarships, private school vouchers, and whether or not those hold up?
Well, yeah, I mean, Jeff, like you said, I mean, the more each dollar that you put in the Opportunity Scholarship Fund, it could be money, less money for public schools. I mean, I think one thing when we were just talking earlier about whether this money, you know, fully funds private schools, which it does not, many private schools. And I think one thing you're going to see too is private schools are going to raise their tuition. I mean, when you suddenly have all this new money coming into the market, you know, a private school that may have cost $25,000 a year, they're going to go up in price, $26,000, $27,000, $28,000. I mean, that is just, we've seen that with higher education. We're going to see that in K-12. But yeah, going back to your original point, it may be a very popular program among parents, but there is a lot of concern that extra $300 million is just $300 million that can't be put into K-12, to public K-12.
Of course, we got the backdrop of the Leandro case and the court-ordered funding that the yep. Republicans in the legislature don't want to go quite to that level because they don't think the courts have the authority. I talked in the past week with Rodney Pierce, who is a middle school social studies teacher up in Northampton County who won a primary for the state house. And I asked him about Leandro. What does this mean for his school that he teaches at? And he argued that what he really needs more funding for is to have the electives that kids in urban counties have at the middle school level for things like music and art that they simply cannot afford in a rural county at the middle school level because of the funding they've got. So these are sort of the trade-offs that the state budget writers are making in terms of how much goes to vouchers versus how much goes into existing public schools.
State legislature is not in at the moment. We'll return for its short session here at the end of the month. What else did you glean this week about what is a high priority item, what can be expected when lawmakers do come back in for what we think is largely, mostly a May and June session? Don Vaughn?
I mean, Speaker Moore, it's the, you know, he says it's going to be short. I will believe it when I see it. Yep. His chief of staff, Neil Inman, also tweeted that it's going to be short. Why wouldn't it be? And I'm like, fool me once.
Why wouldn't it be? I can give you about 14
reasons
why it might not
be. You know, they've already have all this stuff done. So we have some indications of what already is going to happen. There's going to be an ICE bill. Dustin Hall has talked about that. There might, that looks like there'll be some sort of defunding of DEI on campuses, some version of that. Looks like that's what's coming up. Maybe there wasn't as much excitement for more on that. Maybe as others that are interested in moving that ahead. And I think, I believe, like, Colin, you were there. I feel like Moore mentioned video lottery terminals,
yeah,
which is
more
kind
gambling.
Of this extra,
I think they've shifted away from the idea of more casinos because that's proven a little bit politically unpopular. But the idea of video lottery terminals, which basically little gambling stations that you could put in gas stations and bars all over the state, that's something that sounds like there's appetite to at least go through the process on in the short session. We'll see how far it actually gets this time around.
And some raises in the budget, because one of my follows for Moore was, if you're going to spend $300 million on private schools, does this mean that teachers may not get raises? You know, it's the second year, so they get like the second half of their raise, but something more than that. And he said, nope. And I asked teachers and school personnel, because, you know, they are the people that make the least money that work in education. And he said there are raises and for state employees, which is separate. Yeah.
Quick civics reminder here in North Carolina, as Don just alluded to, lawmakers pass a two-year budget in odd-numbered years, and then in these even-numbered years, they can go back and they can adjust or fix the budget based on revenue, whether there is more or less than what was projected or anticipated. And teachers are, I believe, set to receive a 3% raise on July 1st. That's just coming from my brain, so I might be wrong on that, but I believe it's a 3% raise as established last summer. One other education point I wanted to just touch on here, because Colin included it in some of his reports this week, and I thought it was a really interesting and important point, is we began this conversation a few moments ago talking about a potential $300 million additional investment in private school vouchers. Don, you know teacher salaries. It's a question mark. And Colin, there is an issue for many daycares across the state because they've lost federal funding. It was COVID relief funding.
Yeah, expires in June, so they're on the precipice here of this sort of funding cliff that's going to result in either, you know, cuts to programs. Some may actually have to close. Increases in cost to families, which Jeff, you and I already know from our own children, is not an inexpensive prospect to put a child in a daycare facility. So that's something going to deal with. And Moore was sort of noncommittal when we asked about whether that ask is going to be fulfilled to sort of increase these subsidies so that there's some sort of backfill to this federal funding that's going to go away. It seems like there's not really consensus yet among legislators as to whether they want to make that a problem they want to address.
You show me your budget, I will show you your priorities, good, bad, or indifferent. But a budget tells you a lot about what you value.
Very few of them have young children, which is a point that I sometimes bring up, is that the lawmakers are older, so it's been a while since their kids were in some sort of childcare facility, if they ever were.
Even like before COVID, childcare costs was always an issue. It's incredibly expensive, and the people that work there are not paid very much. So it's always been an issue, and demand has always been high.
Danielle, this is a hybrid state-federal issue in the sense that it was federal funding that really started flowing to the states, and then, as Colin notes, is going to end on June 30th. What, if anything, can you tell us about this conversation on Capitol Hill, and if anything's in the pipeline?
There's been conversations about bringing it back. I think Representative Adams is one that has talked about it often, about wanting to bring it back and having it there. But again, Capitol Hill can't get anything done. We're in another situation where we can't even get a rule vote to pass. They're trying it again today. And so if Congress can actually get work done, that would be great to see if we can actually get to a child care bill.
Danielle Battaglia.
Sorry, Capitol Hill.
Yeah, Danielle Battaglia on the line, McClatchy Capitol Hill correspondent. We still have a speaker of the U.S. House, right? Mike Johnson is still the speaker as we are chatting here at 10:30 on a Friday morning.
I've been watching my phone pretty closely to make sure. I mean, there's the threat from Marjorie Taylor Greene that she's going to do a motion to vacate on him. They are doing this vote on the FISA rule right now. Mm-hmm. And as soon as he's done with that, he is traveling to Mar-a-Lago to meet with President Trump to try to mitigate some of this. It's anyone's guessing game on how that's going to go.
Messy. It's all messy. Continues to be messy. Mm-hmm. It's like a Waffle House at 3 a.m. It is messy. Let's move on to the absurd, outlandish, and the can we please try not to let this become normal comments of one Michelle Morrow. Some listeners will remember that Morrow called for public executions of several Democrats. The comments made years ago on social media were unearthed following Morrow's upset of Republican incumbent State Superintendent Catherine Truitt in the March 5th primary. Don, Colin, y'all, among others, have been trying to get Republican legislative leaders on the record about Morrow's long-ago comments. Ooh, who said what this week?
Well, Speaker Moore was asked about it. As I mentioned, you know, we talked to reporters the other day, and it was interesting what he said. He said what he's heard, you know, are not appropriate.
He does not condone the comments that she made about Obama and others.
Right, and that he wouldn't make it, which is interesting that that's a similar phrasing, obviously different types of comments. But Morrow makes Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson look, you know, like unicorns and rainbows for like his comment comparison. But Robinson has said a lot of mean things about transgender and other LGBTQ people. And when we asked Senator Leader Berger about it, I don't know, sometime maybe when he was endorsing Robinson, he said, those aren't things I would say. And then moved on. And what Moore said about Morrow is he said he went beyond saying it, you know, it was inappropriate, all these things, because obviously it's extremist. And he said, I wouldn't have said it, but he is still going to vote for her because the phrase good, loyal Republican.
Good, loyal Republican. He will support his party's nominees. So this is very much, I mean, it's a line a lot of Republicans seem to be walking with Morrow, with Robinson, with Donald Trump. It's, well, I wouldn't have said these comments. I don't agree with these comments, but I'm a good foot soldier for my political party, and I'm going to do whatever the party tells me to do, essentially, is the line we're getting.
Steve Harrison on the line from WFAE in Charlotte. A thought or three?
Yeah, I think one thing, Jeff, I mean, remember a couple months ago before the primary, we talked about the upcoming fall election. And of course, you know, Biden-Trump was going to dominate. We all knew that Stein-Robinson in the governor's race would be a huge thing. But a lot of us thought that this attorney general's race between Jeff Jackson and Dan Bishop, these two political heavyweights, would be top of mind. The Michelle Morrow comments and this race has just devoured the news cycle. I mean, I just think it's fascinating that this Jackson Bishop race, which has, like I said, these two huge figures in North Carolina politics, is not only third billing, it seems to be fifth billing. And I mean, and that may change, but I just think it's fascinating how Dan Bishop, who a few years ago was a hugely polarizing figure, everyone talked about him, but old news, you know?
Steve he almost seems like a moderate compared to some of the other folks on his party's ticket this year.
Steve Harrison publishes,
no, exactly. Yeah.
Steve Harrison publishes a newsletter each week, Inside Politics, WFAE. I hope
That's
I didn't
it.
Just,
yeah.
That is it. Thank you. Inside Politics from WFAE, NPR member station in Charlotte. And Steve, you wrote about this a few weeks ago, kind of the normalization or the middling of Dan Bishop, which is, and I say this respectfully, objectively, it's almost a preposterous thing to think about, but it really has happened in the last few years. I want to turn to Danielle Battaglia in a moment, but first, let's hear from Michelle Morrow, who went on Steve Bannon's podcast earlier this week, just to reiterate that she's talking truth.
I've been speaking truth in talking about how we want to get back to the basics of education and exposing what's been happening in our schools, the failures of the left in the radical agendas and the political and sexual and racially explicit stuff that's poisoning our children's minds and keeping them from getting a good education.
I will note, I didn't hear anything about public executions in there. Danielle, you were ready before to say something. The conversation has just progressed, but I want to work you in here. Thoughts on Michelle Morrow?
Well, I'll go to 2 points. On Dan Bishop, if you watch him when he decided to run for attorney general, that's when you saw him take a more moderate stance, that he has gone towards the middle. And I've heard that so he doesn't upset the more middle of the road Republican voter and can keep those votes basically on his side. Mm-hmm. And it's playing out like on on the floor of the House. And I've been really interested to watch that. Prior to that, I was going to say, I'm really interested with Michelle to watch what key Republicans continue to say, because a couple years ago, I did a story about whether Mark Robinson and Congressman Cawthorn, who, if you all remember, was very controversial, if they were the future of the Republican Party and if different lawmakers were okay with their speech. And I was always really curious about why they came out and said, we're not okay with Madison Cawthorn, but we are okay with Mark Robinson. We wouldn't say what he says, but we know his heart, and he's okay. So I'm really curious if that will change up during this election.
Well, Mark Robinson never accused them of having inappropriate sexual parties at the congressional level, so I guess that may have been the difference.
He hasn't come for them in the same way, although he has come for Tillis, right, Daniel?
Yes, they are not getting along right now.
Let me just say, if anyone has forgotten Madison Cawthorn, I want what's ever in your coffee cup. Right?
Such an unforgettable figure in North Carolina politics. There are images that I can't get out of my brain, and I'm not going to describe them on the
radio. Why are you even bringing it up, Colin? Now we're all thinking about it.
I know.
So one other thing, I know everybody here knows this, and I bet a lot of our listeners know this, but one thing that strikes me as interesting, maybe just worth putting out there, is as we think about this superintendent race, which is Michelle Morrow versus Mo Green, former superintendent of Guilford County Schools, we think about the superintendent position relative to the attorney general's race between Dan Bishop and Jeff Jackson, both outgoing congressmen. The AG's seat, the AG role, is far more powerful and far more important in many ways than the superintendent's race. So that is something that we are going to continue to track. Michelle Morrow's comments, I'm sure others will weigh in on that in the months to come. North Carolina Friday News Roundup here on Due South with Colin, Don, Danielle, and Steve. We got a little bit more to get to on the other side. Stay with us. It's Due South on listener-supported North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tabiri here in studio with Don Vaughn, Capitol Bureau Chief at the News and Observer. Danielle Battaglia is on the line. She's Capitol Hill correspondent for McClatchy. Steve Harrison is with us as well from the Queen City. He's politics reporter, political reporter at member station WFAE in Charlotte. And Colin Campbell, Capitol Bureau Chief at WUNC, is here in studio as well. I actually have one more question on the Michelle Morrow thing that I wanted to get to y'all. I think really more Don and Colin, but I want to tee this up as Tim Moore, Republican House Speaker, longest serving House Speaker in history, spoke about Morrow's comments this week. He is the outgoing speaker. He's running for Congress in a safely drawn, gerrymandered district. And I was curious, why did he even address this? He's been ducking it for weeks. Why not continue to duck it? Why talk about it now? He doesn't need to get into this, does he?
It's hard for him to duck things when we're all standing around him.
He loves to talk, and so for him to give us a no comment would be very rare for him.
I think, and Laura Leslie, with WRAL's Capitol Bureau chief, she was like, what do you mean by that? You know, loyal Republican. And Moore laid out, he's like, this is the primary process, and this is what voters chose. So I think from Moore's perspective, one, he's running and doesn't want to lose any votes, you know, even though he's pretty much a shoo-in in his race because of the way the district looks. But he doesn't want to be the one that says, I'm a Republican, vote for me, Republicans, and then also say, I don't want Republicans to vote for another Republican, because then, like you said, he would be accused of being disloyal. Yeah,
and Tim Moore has never had a competitive general election in his life. He may never have a competitive general election in his life. He runs in deep red districts where his only potential threat comes in the primary for perhaps another Republican who might say he's not Republican enough or not loyal enough to the party. So I think that's kind of his general philosophy when he approaches situations like this.
Plus, Moore endorsed Trump, like just the week or two before he announced his run, because that's the whether or not you believe he actually likes Trump or not. Because that's what was the thing that he needed to do politically. So I believe there could be that aspect here.
You follow the factions, you fall in line, you make sure that you have access to the money, which, of course, is a major component of all of this. All right, we're going to pinwheel things a little bit here on the North Carolina News Roundup on Due South. I want to focus on some of the reporting that each of you have done this week. Danielle, we're going to start with you. You published a couple of stories this week, part of the Beyond the Border series that McClatchy Papers ran. One of the stories that I'm most interested to hear from you on, it's about kids who cross the U.S. border, the southern U.S. border, alone and or without a parent or a guardian. And what you focused on were some of these young children, these migrant children who end up in Greensboro. Tell us about the facility you reported on and why some officials have concerns.
So it's a complex issue, but basically the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is under DHHS, they are obligated to take these kids under their wing when they cross the border. And these are kids mostly from Guatemala and Honduras who cross the border without an adult with them. Sometimes they have an adult, but if it's not their legal guardian, they're still taken into custody as basically an orphan, for lack of a better word. And they are taken into these facilities that are supposed to be holding them until they are found to have a sponsor in the U.S. that can keep them while they go through the immigration process. A lot of the times these kids are escaping really bad situations in their home countries. Sometimes they've been trafficked. Sometimes they are trying to come here to earn a living wage to send back to their parents in their countries. And so these kids are housed at these pretty large facilities where, I mean, they have bunk beds that are in rooms. I've saw videos of it, and they're just stacked together. They're fed, they're clothed. From the HHS point of view, it looks pretty flowery and great, like they're taking care of these kids. But when you start talking to our officials, and let me step back for a minute. So our officials found out that HHS has a contract now with the American Hebrew Academy in Greensboro, which is this huge facility, to basically open what is considered an influx center. So if they run out of room at one of these other facilities, the kids will then go to Greensboro to live until they find a sponsor.
Okay.
And so our lawmakers started looking into it. And one of the things that really bothered them is they weren't given any information about this. They found out because locals had seen planes with government markings on it at PTI, the airport in Greensboro. And then they also were seeing people on the ground saying, we're with HHS, we're thinking about opening this influx center. They called Representative Richard Hudson, who happened to be in a meeting that day with HHS Secretary Javier Becerra, and he asked him about it, and he said, we have no plans to open a facility in North Carolina. Hmm. Well, his guys were on the ground saying, yes, we are. So Hudson wasn't happy about this. And
so that's either bad communication or somebody's being disingenuous.
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
And Hudson's take is it was disingenuous. And the more they looked into it, they're hearing, you know, these kids have been sexually harassed at these facilities. They're not going to save sponsors. They're being trafficked. There's a plethora of things from like dirty laundry, different things that they're concerned about and not getting answers from HHS.
Are these children, I guess, how long are they there for? And in the short term, are they being integrated in schools? Are they being connected to civic circles or religious communities? Or like, are they, who's supporting them? Or they're just being cast off in these facilities?
So the average is 27 days until they find a sponsor. Technically, they should not be there for more than 20 days by law. And they are not, they are supposed to be staying within the facility. They are not supposed to ever leave the facility. So there's a lot of concern from the surrounding community in Greensboro about whether these kids could go to the schools or go to local hospitals. The answer to that HHS gives is they should never be leaving the facility. I do have questions because if you look at the documentation that's online, you know, if there's a hurricane, tornado, fire at this facility, like where do the kids go? How do you deal with that? And then also, if they are massively hurt and they can't deal with it there, they obviously have to go to a local hospital. So there are questions like that are lingering in the minds of people like Senator Tillis and Representative Hudson and the mayor of Greensboro.
You can read Danielle Battaglia's reporting at newsobserver.com. Certainly something I think we'll ask you about in the weeks to come as we learn more about what is happening, if there's a change in the facility in Greensboro, so on and so forth. I want to transition to Steve Harrison in Charlotte. Steve, there was a plan to use public money to turn an old Duke Energy headquarters facility into apartments. There was a plan. I'm going to underscore the word plan. That then went to you know what. What happened with this plan and why?
Yeah, Jeff, I think it's interesting because I think, you know, across the country and in Raleigh, we've got empty office buildings. What do we do with them? Can we breathe new life into them, maybe turn them into residential units? That debate is happening here in Charlotte. Like you said, the Duke Energy's old headquarters in downtown Charlotte is empty now. A developer bought it with plans to turn it into new retail and apartments. They announced these big plans, but they can't afford it now. It's just too expensive. And the city council in Charlotte was all on board with this, thought it'd be a great idea. And then our county commission, Mecklenburg commissioners, heard the plan, heard the idea, and just hated it. I mean, absolutely kicked this idea around. One reason is there will be no affordable housing in it because, of course, that will make it more expensive. So I think kind of the underlying theme here is that these conversions, taking an old office building and trying to make them residential, is really hard. It's really expensive. And, you know, and I think we're going to be seeing this play out all over the country when people try and do these projects and find out it's just really hard.
So you note that the county commissioners wanted affordable housing within a refurbishment, a redo of this building. And the developers, and this is my very loose understanding of this, really don't like these low-income units, not because they have an issue necessarily with people who live in low-income units, but they don't make any money off of these low-income units. Is there a middle ground here? Like, is there another step forward where the developers or private equity might come back and be like, all right, well, we'll throw you this number of X units, and is there a middle ground?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're going to have to see, because right now is kind of the project is planned is dead. It seems to be dead. So they're going to have to come back with some kind of effort to probably put in some kind of affordable units. But, you know, a big thing will be, you know, for a long time, we built affordable housing at, you know, 80% AMI, you know, we're slightly affordable. That, of course, is more financially feasible for a developer. But you know, the real need in Charlotte, and I'm sure in the Triangle as well, is for people who make, you know, 50% of area median income, 30%. That's the real need. And that's what's really, really, really hard for developers to make work.
AMI, area median income, and the cost of so much of this is going up. That's Steve Harrison. He's with WFAE in Charlotte. Colin Campbell, two North Carolina congresswomen are facing criticism for quietly visiting Israel amid the ongoing war. Who visited, and why are they facing criticism?
So this is two Democrats, Congresswoman Kathy Manning from Greensboro, I think the only Jewish member of North Carolina's congressional delegation, mm-hmm. as well as Representative Valerie Fushi from Orange County, a very liberal district. Both of these women took a trip that was sponsored by AIPAC, which is a pro-Israel lobbying group that has funneled significant amounts of campaign contributions to both of their campaigns over time. They went there. They met with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. They toured some areas that were affected in the October attacks on Israel last year. But they're under a lot of criticism because, for one, they didn't announce this either before, during, or after. They did say there was a security concern about saying anything publicly before they visited or while they were there. But even
afterward.
You know, after the fact, you know, you typically see members of Congress say, last week I was in Ukraine or some other sort of war-torn area that they felt the need to visit. These folks did not put out any sort of statement or press release until after media started asking questions about it. And so they faced a lot of criticism you know, amid all the concerns about Israel's handling of this war, that they're essentially standing with Israel, you know, visiting the prime minister and perhaps out of step with particularly the more liberal elements of their district that are, you know, calling for ceasefires, concerned about all the deaths and carnage in Palestine, in the Gaza Strip. And so there's a lot of pushback on that. You saw an op-ed come out in the past week from Nida Alam, who is the Muslim member of the Durham County Board of Commissioners and was also the primary challenger to Fushi when she ran in 2022, saying that, you know, this is essentially your accusing Fushi of essentially standing with genocide. So this is some really heated rhetoric around this, a lot of pressure on these members of Congress.
And I will note from a timing standpoint that this trip by Valerie Fushi, who defeated Nida Alam, a Muslim candidate a couple of years ago, happened after the primary, it's not like someone was going to jump into a primary race, but it happened a little bit later in the election cycle. And you mentioned officials talking about visits they've made after the fact. Tim Moore went to Ukraine. He snuck into Ukraine.
Yeah, Wiley Nickel was in Ukraine the last week and put out a big press release about it, offered himself up to interviews about what he learned while he was there.
I don't think Fauci had a Democratic primary challenger.
This time around, which
that was
is interesting.
Surprise. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess to your point, she could have gone in February or March. There really may not have been.
But certainly before the filing season when people were really fired up about being angry about how she's handling this.
Just a few more minutes here on our North Carolina News Roundup on Due South. We have heard from Danielle and Colin and Steve about some of their reporting this week. And now we need to hear from Don Vaughn. You're on the government beat. You cross paths with the governor regularly. And this week, your reporting noted that, well, Governor Roy Cooper won't explicitly say what he wants to do next year. There might be some clues.
Yeah, I mean, come on. You know, he sat at the table with the president at the state dinner. Yes, the Japanese prime minister is coming here, but also he's buddies with Biden and with Harris. Cooper and Vice President Harris were both attorneys general at the same time. So they go back for a while every time Biden or Harris comes to North Carolina, which is every other day about. Cooper, of course, is there in his role as governor, but he's also a surrogate for their campaign. And, you know, I've asked him, everybody has asked him, what are you going to do? And you know, and he kind of just deferred for a while. Then he eventually started saying public service. So what does that actually look like? And so this past the last Council of State meeting, when he talked to reporters briefly after, I asked him, you know, do you want to work for them next year? That's a valid question. And Cooper said he's not thinking about next year. I mean, again, come on. Obviously, you are. You know, maybe he said the quiet part to himself in this moment during our conversation, you know, or like whatever. But I'm sure every other time he is thinking about next year. And if Biden and Harris win re-election, I will not be shocked in any manner if Cooper gets an appointment.
Winnow it down a little bit for us. If you even have a theory, and we are totally prognosticating crystal ball here, but I remember with former Governor Pat McCrory, he was itching for a post in the Trump administration. I believe it was FEMA that he wanted to be the head of. Is there something in particular that you think Roy Cooper is interested in and or would be best for?
Well, if you think about what does Cooper like to talk about, what does he want his legacy to be? And that sort of shifted, you know, over time. It was COVID response for a while, it was Medicaid expansion. He, you know, obviously constantly talks about public school teachers and teacher pay. The past year or so, he's been big on talking about infrastructure. Of course, he loves electric vehicles. If you look at just his face when he's all those photos.
A lot of potential cabinet posts. It really depends on what's open, right?
Right. So we're looking at EPA. We're looking at education, I think. Transportation, even like those are kind of the things. Plus, you know, Cooper is like, you know, it's fair to say he's kind of a nerd. He's a policy guy and something that's more in the weeds, I think, than whiz bang.
And the other thing to watch out for 2026 is when there's another U.S. Senate race with Tom Tillis's seat. I would imagine Democrats are really hoping to recruit Cooper, who has had a pretty good victory track record in general elections statewide, to run for that seat.
And he's good at raising money, which you need to do to run for U.S. Senate. So I think that would be the alternative, if not an appointment.
Interesting. One more news note on the way out here. The NC State University will celebrate its men's and women's basketball teams Monday night at the Memorial Bell Tower along Hillsborough Street. Both teams, of course, played in the Final Four last weekend. Women lost to eventual national champ South Carolina, and the men fell to Purdue. Kevin Keats, Wes Moore, those are the coaches, along with players from both teams, will be at the free event that takes place 8 o'clock on Monday night. We're unfortunately just about out of time. Danielle Battaglia, who is the McClatchy Capitol Hill correspondent, Steve Harrison, politics reporter at member station WFAE in Charlotte, Don Vaughn, Capitol Bureau Chief for the News and Observer, and Colin Campbell, Capitol Bureau Chief at WUNC. Thanks, y'all. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Jeff.
All right. Remember, if you missed anything, DueSouthRadio.org, WUNC.org. We'll be back with you for a fresh slate of news, politics, race and Southern culture, environmental and economic news stories and narratives next week here on WUNC. This is Due South. Due South is a production of WUNC and a broadcast service at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our producers are Stacia Brown, Cole Del Charco, and Rachel McCarthy. Denarius Thomas is our technical director. Aaron Kiever is our EP, executive producer. Our theme music is by Quilla. For Leonita Inge, my name is Jeff Tiberi. We'll talk to you again on Monday.